All right, we're going to go ahead and get started. My name is Marie Fisher. I'd like to welcome you here to the Women on Wednesday series, Still Fighting for Our Rights 30 Years Later. A few housekeeping items before we get started. Please turn off all cell phones and pagers, and please stay in your seats until 12:50. Also, if you could please fill out the evaluation sheet, as we do use this information for future programming. And check out the back table for upcoming events, the Vagina Monologues, on February 14th and 15th, as well as the RAD self-defense course. The debate on reproductive rights was one of the most contentious issues addressed at the National Conference 30 years ago, and this debate continues today. In addition to addressing the basic issue of choice and gender equity, our presenter will talk about the misperceptions and facts of the U.S. Supreme Court ruling Roe v. Wade, and the realities of access to reproductive health care. Leah Hebert is currently the Director of Programs and Development at the Midwest Health Center for Women and was Executive Director of Pro-Choice Resources for 7 years prior to this position. Hebert is an alum of St. Cloud State University with a bachelor's in English and a former student activist and leader in the Women's Equality Group, now known as Women's Action. We are very grateful to have her with us today. Please join the Women's Center in welcoming Leah Hebert.
Thank you. I'm just going to pre-apologize for the cold that I am getting over and that I might need to have a cough drop while I'm talking. Let's see. My name is Leah Hebert, but that's okay. Hebert is fine, too. That's okay. And I graduated here in 1995, and I was on the stage a few times doing radical women's equality group things. So here I am again. I want to just start out by saying I am the Director of Programs and Development at Midwest Health Center, which is a reproductive health clinic, and we do many different things, contraception, annual exams, OBGYN, and we do abortions. So I just want that to be out there, that we are an abortion clinic. Before that, I was the Executive Director at Pro-Choice Resources, and I'll talk a little bit about that later. Most of the issues that we deal with are around access to healthcare, and I'm sure that some of you are here for a class, so I have lots of good handouts for you to use later when you have to talk about what you learned today. So the other thing I just want to say briefly is that abortion is definitely an emotional, moral, personal issue that people have lots and lots of opinions about, and so I'm totally willing to engage in a discussion about it, but I didn't really come here to debate today. And so if there's going to be lots of questions about how I can live with myself or how do I live with murdering babies and things like that, I'm willing to have that discussion, but I'm not really willing to engage in a debate. I can give you the facts and about Roe v. Wade and about abortion and about reproductive health care, and I'm totally, that's what I'm here to do, but I just want to preface it by saying that I didn't come to have a one-on-one debate with anybody about whether abortion is morally right or wrong, because we all come to this room with an opinion about that, and I'm probably not going to change your mind if you have a strong opinion one way or another, and you're probably not going to change my mind. So I think it's kind of a waste of time for the other people in the room if we have a back and forth session for the next 35 or 40 minutes. So that being said, I do want you guys to ask questions at any point. Stop me anytime you have a question about something. And if I don't know the answer, I'll just tell you that I don't know the answer. But like I said, I have some handouts, so maybe that will help too. But please feel free to ask a question at any point. The first thing that I want to talk about a little bit is about Roe v. Wade. A lot of people think that there's a federal law that makes abortion legal in the United States, which in fact there is not. There is a Supreme Court decision which found that, and I'm going to pass this off to you guys while I'm talking a little bit. It started in Texas, and it was a Supreme Court decision, and basically what it found was that our Constitution gave a woman right to privacy, and so it's an interpretation of the Constitution. It is not a federal law. So there is no law that protects abortion in this country. The Supreme Court that was sitting at that time and so far up until now believed that the Constitution protected a woman's right to have abortion. That's how they interpreted it. It started in 1970. With a woman who challenged the abortion laws in Texas. The court in Texas, it was a district court, found that she could have an abortion. They allowed her to have an abortion, but they did not overturn the restrictive laws against abortion in Texas. Thus, then, the case was appealed ultimately to the Supreme Court, and in 1973, the sitting Supreme Court found that restrictive laws against abortion were unconstitutional and that women had the constitutional right to have an abortion. So I think that's an important first step, and I also think what's important is what Roe v. Wade actually says, because there's a lot of misconceptions about Roe v. Wade and about abortion laws in the United States, a lot of misconceptions about the fact that Roe v. Wade just legalized abortion across the board. You can have an abortion until you're 9 months pregnant for any reason you want to, and that's not actually what Roe v. Wade said. Roe v. Wade was very, very specific about that, and actually it's on your handout that it divided it into trimesters. It was actually one of the first times legally that we even talked about trimesters on a legal basis. So up to 12 weeks in the first trimester, the state cannot restrict a woman's right to an abortion. So no state can say, we outlaw abortion up to the 12 weeks in any state. The second trimester, which is generally considered 13 to 23 weeks, it says the state can regulate the abortion procedure during that trimester in ways that are reasonably related to maternal health. And the third trimester, which is 24 weeks and up, the state can choose to restrict abortion in that trimester as long as there is an exception for the preservation of the life or health of the woman. So, and most states have done that. I think it's 40 or 41 states that have actually restricted abortion, in that third trimester, except for the preservation of the life or the health of the mother. And Minnesota is not one of those states, although no third trimester abortions are done in Minnesota. Well, two were done in 2005 in Minnesota. They are both done in hospitals for medical reasons. So if anybody is interested or wants to see what abortions were done in Minnesota and why and what procedures are being used and that kind of thing, one of the things in Minnesota that we have to do at abortion clinics is report all of those statistics to the Department of Health. So if you go on the Minnesota Department of Health website, there's what's called you can just search abortion report. And for every year, for the last, I can't quite remember when this law happened. I don't know, 2002 or 3 or maybe before that. There is every, June or something at the end of the year, the report goes on there. So right now you can see, you can get that report. It's about 30 pages long, and it has everything and more that you'd ever want to know about why abortions are being done in Minnesota. So that's the trimester. So definitely Roe v. Wade recognized a point where a fetus was viable, which means that even with artificial help, a fetus could survive outside of its mother, and that's generally viewed now at 24 weeks. That wasn't viewed at 24 weeks. It was viewed later, back in 73, and potentially in your lifetime it will be viewed earlier with technology. I mean, it really, viability is one of those things that is up in the air. It's not a definitive thing. As technology gets better, we could certainly see, artificial, being able to keep fetuses alive earlier and earlier and earlier, and there are cases that they've been kept alive, born prematurely and kept alive earlier. The chances of, and certainly this is not part of this discussion, but you don't really want a fetus being born that early. I mean, the astronomical chances of having severe defects for the rest of their life, they're simply not done growing, and so viability is definitely an issue that is gray, and during your lifetime will probably, in my lifetime I guess, I'm not that much older than you, will definitely evolve. So did I see somebody with their hand up? No? Okay. So the court found that the state has an interest in potential life, and that's how they phrased it, was potential life. So since 1973, there have been a lot of Supreme Court decisions, or maybe not a lot, but many, Supreme Court decisions that have tacked onto Roe v. Wade. I mean, they have, changed it. It's evolved. It continues to evolve. Most of you probably have heard many times about why it's important Supreme Court justices, that every time a different Supreme Court justice gets in there, that the law is being interpreted differently. And so the question of could Roe v. Wade be overturned, I mean, there's definitely, that is a definite possibility, depending on, looking at the makeup of the Supreme Court, because, again, there's no federal law, so it really depends on how those sitting justices interpret our Constitution. People, it's a different kind of interpretation of the Constitution to find privacy. Other justices don't feel that way. So, I mean, it definitely does matter who the Supreme Court justices are, and that will make a big difference. That is one way that people are trying to restrict abortion, is definitely working on, you know, getting Supreme Court justices in there who will rule on an abortion case and will not find, you know, in the same way. But I think most of the efforts have been put into restricting and regulating abortion. And that's really what we see across the country, and it's definitely, you know, and in Minnesota, is that a lot of the legislative efforts of people who, you know, the pro-life movement or the anti-choice movement have been on restricting access to abortion and regulating abortion. And so, and there's a lot of different ways to do that, and their ultimate goal is to make abortion harder and harder to get so that nobody will be able to get one. And if they can't outlaw it on the, you know, national level, then they would try and make it harder and harder and harder until ultimately, and we see already that there's a lot of groups of people who aren't being able, you know, they don't have equal access to abortion and aren't being able to get it. So, and I can talk about that a little bit. In Minnesota, we have a slightly, well, our Supreme Court has found that the Minnesota state constitution is even, affords more privacy than the United States Constitution. So what that means is if Roe v. Wade were overturned and the Supreme Court found that they didn't interpret the Constitution that way anymore, about 40 states in the country already have laws on the books that say if Roe v. Wade is overturned, abortion will become illegal in that state. So many, many states are prepared for it to be illegal. In Minnesota, so far, our Constitution is a little bit more, affords more privacy. That's how our Constitution has been interpreted by the Minnesota State Supreme Court. So if Roe v. Wade were overturned right now, we would still have legal abortion in Minnesota. So that, does that make sense? Does anybody have any question about that? Okay. I think that from, you know, pro-choice perspective and for the purpose of this discussion, you know, I'll define what being pro-choice is. You know, for me, it really is about having abortion as an option. I can tell you that for me personally, I was a mom at 17. I have a 17-year-old child who is about to graduate from high school this year. And I chose to carry that pregnancy to term. I considered placing her up for adoption. I went through the whole adoption process and in the very end changed my mind. And so I had her while I was here at school. And then while I was here, she was about 2.5. I had terminated a pregnancy in the city, so I had an abortion. And I have a 2-year-old. So I have run the gamut with reproductive health decisions. And for me, being pro-choice means that I had that option of parenting, of placing my child up for adoption, or of having an abortion. And I don't define being pro-choice as being pro-abortion or thinking that it's the right choice for anybody else. And I think that it's an option that should be available for everybody, but each person has to decide individually what that means to them. I think that most, you know, in the pro-choice movement, we look at abortion as simply a part of reproductive health care, that, you know, the contraception and prevention of pregnancy, that, you know, adequate access to birth control, prenatal care, that your choices about having babies are not being restricted. If you want to have 5 babies, you should be able to have 5 babies. That there's a whole reproductive justice and reproductive health is like a whole gamut of issues, and legal abortion is one of those issues. There's a lot of work that's being done, you know, especially led by women of color, around redefining it as reproductive justice. And they're really looking at it in a new framework, which is, you know, we're dealing with issues of the rights to have children and bear children, the right to adequate prenatal care, the history of forced sterilization, and still continues to be urged sterilization and urged birth control access on low-income women and women of color, that all of those issues are connected, and that and so there's a really strong movement out there around reproductive justice and looking at it from that framework. So, which I think is a much more interesting framework, and also brings in perspectives of people who haven't always contributed to the debate and to the conversation. So, I wanted to make sure that you guys have true information about what the facts are nationally and in Minnesota around abortion and abortion laws. So, I'll wait until you get that. Abortion is one of the most commonly performed procedures in the United States. In 2005, which is when the best figures are available at this point, over 1 million women obtained abortions in the United States. And I think the statistics, I think there's a lot of misperceptions about who gets an abortion in the United States. So I think it's important for people to see that 57% of women are in their 20s, 60% already have children, 86% are unmarried, 57% are low income, 78% identify themselves as religious or have a religious affiliation. They're Catholic. Some evangelicals or even born-again Christians, that there are a lot, you know, the vast majority of people who have abortions are not atheists, and they are religious people who struggle to figure that out in their own religions. And 41% are white. So if you look at the how many abortions, you can see that 1 in 3 American women has an abortion by the time she reaches the age of 45. And that's a lot more common than people think. And I think that one of the reasons that we don't know that is because there's such a stigma in this country about having an abortion, and that you wouldn't tell your friend or tell your boyfriend or talk about it with people that you know. But if you think 1 in 3 women, how, you know, in your circle of friends, that's, you know, that's quite a few. So 19% of all pregnancies in the United States end in abortion. And a little bit about when people are having abortions, 88% of them occur in the first 12 weeks. So I'm sure that a lot of you heard about or are aware of the discussions around late-term abortions and partial birth abortion and how much attention that got in the media. There are actually less than 2,000 abortions a year that happen in the third trimester in the United States. So there aren't very many that are happening, and the vast, vast majority of those are happening because of, you know, a pretty life-threatening situation to the mother or a severe fetal anomaly. So the fetus is has a variety of things is not compatible with life when it's born. Those are really, really hard decisions. When I worked at Pro-Choice Resources, one of the programs we have there, and I have some information for you, is called the Hersey Fund. And one of the things we do is give away money to women who can't afford to pay for the cost of an abortion. In Minnesota, an abortion costs, a first trimester abortion costs about $400, and people don't take checks, and they don't take a payment plan, so you have to come up with cash ahead of time. And then if you're past 12 weeks, you can add about $100 a week. So women who are having abortions at 18 weeks, let's say, you know, are paying almost $1,000 or more. When you look at a third trimester abortion, you're looking around $6,000 to $10,000. So for third trimester abortions, obviously it's not something that people are entering into lightly. They have to come up with $10,000 to be able to do that. We gave out grants and loans to women through the Hersey Fund of about $100 to $250. And I think the last year that I was there, we gave out about $140,000, and we could have given out 5 times that much from women across the country. So cost is a pretty big barrier to women who need an abortion. But the women that we did help in the third trimester were terrible stories. They were women, I know for myself, I didn't get an ultrasound till I was 20 weeks pregnant. So if you are to find out something about your fetus, it most of the time happens when you're after 20 or 21 weeks, maybe later. And then by the time you get a second ultrasound, it's 25 weeks. And you find out that your fetus has hydrocephalus, which is water on the brain, and that the head is going to become the size of a basketball, and that there's no way for you to have a vaginal delivery, and that the baby will probably die either in utero or right afterwards. is simply not compatible for life. You're 26 weeks pregnant, and your abortion, it's a wanted child. You and your partner have planned for this, and you have your nursery painted, and you have all, you know, baby clothes, and you've registered, and then you find out that, you know, what are your choices going to be? And some women in the third trimester in that situation opt to have a late-term abortion. There are several different methods of late-term abortion, and partial birth abortion is not a medically recognized term. It's a term that very, very smartly pro-life people came up with in order to describe that, a late-term abortion, so that it would seem as appalling, you know, as possible, which it certainly is a very difficult thing to do. And most of the women that I talked to were horrified at the idea of having to do that. So I think that too often in these kind of conversations, we lose sight of the humanity and the people who are behind these kind of decisions and how difficult a lot of these decisions are, whether it's a first trimester abortion or whether you're one of the 2,000 women in the United States who have to have a third trimester abortion. So I just think it's important to talk about late-term abortions. Fewer than 1%, so half of a percent of women experience any complications from their abortion. And 87% of U.S. counties have no abortion provider. And that's another big access issue, is that women are traveling hundreds of miles in order to get their abortion. In Minnesota, we have 7 abortion clinics, 1 in Duluth, all the rest in the Twin Cities. So for you here, obviously, it would be hundreds of miles for you to travel to get an abortion. For women up on the Arrowhead or, you know, up farther north, there would be much, much farther. So there is an abortion clinic in Fargo. So some of the women on that side of the state go there. In Minnesota, there's about 14,000 abortions a year, and that's stayed pretty consistent for the last 4 or 5 years. 14% of all pregnancies ended in abortion in Minnesota. We have a slightly lower than average. We have less abortions in Minnesota than the national average. And we have several different laws in Minnesota. We have a parental notification law for minors, which means that if you're under 18, you either have to notify both of your parents and they have to sign that they have been notified, or you have to go to court and talk to a judge, and you have to tell a judge, I can't tell my parents about my abortion, and here's why. And that judge determines whether or not you can have an abortion without your parents' permission. So at the clinic that I work at, we have a lot of, not a lot, but of the minors that we serve a year, a lot of them, the majority of them, choose to only tell one of their parents or not tell their parents. And even if you only have one parent, you still have to go to court and talk to the judge and explain that you don't know the location of your other parent or that your other parent has passed away. You can produce a death certificate, and that would be a good enough reason for you not to have notified your second parent. These are not our regulations or rules. These are laws that were passed that were written by pro-life groups with the help of legislators for the purpose of making it difficult for people to have abortions. I think that some of the other laws in Minnesota is what's called a 24-hour waiting period. Probably most of you or some of you may have heard of that. It happened recently. Lots of states have 24-hour waiting periods. And what the 24-hour waiting period means is that you have to get information about abortion that the state has written. So the state of Minnesota has written up a script that a doctor, a physician, must read to you over the in Minnesota you can do it over the telephone or in person. This doctor must read this information to you, and then you have to wait 24 hours to get your procedure. So the state script reads, it's definitely has some good information in it, and other information in the state script is designed to discourage you from having an abortion. It was written by the Department of Health, since Tim Pawlenty was in office, and I think he's widely considered to be an anti-choice governor. So the people who helped write that legislation, in fact, there was incorrect information in that script that we had to fix and has since changed. But the script talks about child support and, gives you information about, carrying your pregnancy to full term, that kind of thing. And different states have different 24-hour waiting periods and have different scripts, and some of them are much, much worse than Minnesota's. We ended up with a pretty decent one. Now, you probably, a lot of people think, well, why is that a bad thing? I mean, what's the big deal about having to hear something 24 hours in advance of having your procedure? I think some of it is about the intent of the law. The intent of those kind of laws are in order to create more barriers for people. So one intent is that you hear this information and change your mind. Another intent is that what they would have preferred was that you heard that information in person. So that means you, from St. Cloud, drives down to the Twin Cities, hears that information in person, as in most states. We are lucky that it's not that way. You have to hear it from a physician, and then you have to stay in a hotel or with your friends for 24 hours, and then 24 hours later, you get to go back to the same clinic and have your procedure. So what ends up happening is that that's a kind of a barrier for a lot of people. I mean, think about for you with your jobs or with school. You probably have a little bit more flexibility, but once you graduate and you live in St. Cloud, that isn't going to be your reality. You can't get an abortion on Sunday. So, or in some clinics, you can get them on Saturdays, but that still means you're going to miss one day of work. So that's some of the intent of the law. The other thing is it costs abortion clinics a lot of money. And that is, that's absolutely the intent of many of these laws, is that if we can't, like I said before, that if you can't outlaw abortion, then here's some things we can do to make it less, you know, common. We'll make sure that abortion clinics, it costs my abortion clinic about $80,000 a year just to facilitate that small thing. Because what you're doing is you have to pay a physician to make those phone calls, and you're not being you can't raise the cost of your procedures so much to recap that money, and you can't get it, insurance doesn't pay you for that conversation. So you, the business, out of your own pocket, comes up with $80,000 to $100,000 to afford the salary of the doctor who's going to be talking on the telephone with patients. So for some nonprofit clinics, which is what I work for, $80,000 is a ton of money and makes it really difficult to be able to function. So that, and that has been successful and at helping clinics close in other states. So that, especially when you have to have the conversation in person, that takes more staff time, and that's one tactic or one way of getting people to of closing clinics and making sure there's less abortions. So and the other law in Minnesota is that we have we have restrictions on what some people, some organizations who get state funding can say about abortion. So Battered Women's Shelters, some of them, or some other kind of money that, some state money that different nonprofits are getting can't refer their patients to abortion clinics. That's the rule. So if their clients want to talk about that, they just are not able to do that. The last handout I have for you is about abortion myths and realities. And I think it's important because there are a lot of myths, well-funded, well-propagated myths about abortion in this country. The first one is about breast cancer. And I want to just reiterate that my information comes from the Center for Disease Control, the National Institute of Health, which is a branch of the United States government, the World Health Organization, and the Guttmacher Institute. So these are, I mean, I'm not getting it from, you know, I don't know, some church down the street or, you know, I mean, some, I didn't make it up or anything like that. These are pretty well-respected institutions, and some of them really are, you know, in the case of the United States government, didn't really want to have to say that abortion was safe. I mean, they would have preferred to not. So if you look at saying that abortion, you know, the myth I think that a lot of people like to propagate is that abortion causes breast cancer. The reason why that whole thing even started is because it has been researched, and doctors and physicians and scientists have found out that carrying a full-term pregnancy, the hormones that a woman produces during a full-term pregnancy helps reduce her chances of breast cancer. So thus then, if you reverse it, the abortion, you know, it can, you know, that's how the logic happened, is that if you reverse it, that abortion must cause breast cancer as opposed to preventing breast cancer. So there's been lots and lots of studies on that, on both sides of the issue. And so the National Cancer Institute, which is a branch of the Center for Disease Control of the United States government, evaluated studies on abortion and breast cancer in 2003 and did conclude that abortion is not associated with an increase in breast cancer. So That's one. Another a myth is that abortion is unsafe. And I talked about that a little bit, but 97% of women who have 12-week and under abortions don't have any complications at all. And there is no health evidence that a first trimester surgical abortion poses any risk for your ability to have children later. 68,000 women die every year from illegal abortions, which is a leading cause of maternal death in many countries. And actually, in the United States, the statistics on your chances of dying in childbirth are actually higher than your chances of dying from an abortion. So it's a safe procedure that happens many, many times a day. Another myth is that women will stop having abortions if it becomes illegal. And the World Health Organization says that 20 million abortions are performed a year where abortion is illegal, and 26 million are performed in countries where abortion is legal. So we can see that lots of illegal abortions happen. They happen, and I don't know, I guess if you are a woman who's ever been in a situation where you've been pregnant and not known what to do about that, you know that you're pretty desperate at that point. And if it's, you know, for a lot of different reasons, and there's a lot of things that you would do, and for some women, they'll do anything not to be pregnant, and whether that is having an illegal abortion or not, that's the reality of it. And so women died in the United States. The number is debatable about how many women died in the United States from illegal abortion before, Roe v. Wade, but women did die. And so we know that if you regulate abortion, make it safe, have physicians do it out in the open rather than, you know, in the back of Sherburn Hall, that it's a lot better for that to happen. So another myth is that abortion is used as birth control. Half of all women having abortions were using birth control when they got pregnant. And with a woman's fertility, if a woman used abortion as their primary form of birth control, she would have about 30 abortions in her lifetime. We know, because we have to report on this, that 78% of women who have abortions have had one or no abortions previously. So the vast majority of women are not having 7 or 10 or some of the numbers that are bandied about by people who are against abortion. And the last one is that women who have abortions are selfish. And I think this is a more ambiguous one and certainly is about your own opinions about things, but most women have abortions for a wide variety of reasons, and the most common cited reason in studies is that they don't have the money to take care of themselves or more children or a child. I can tell you straight up that was the reason I had my abortion. It's the reason we hear at the clinic the most of the time, when the majority of women who have abortion already have children. And so people are having abortions because they can't take care of their kids, and they can't afford to have more kids. So and then in addition, about 13,000 abortions happen per year due to incest or rape, which obviously is not a selfish reason to have an abortion. Talking a little bit about access issues that I talked about before, just some information for you. Less than 50% of medical schools in the United States actually teach about abortion. You can graduate from the University of Minnesota as an OBGYN, and you've never performed an abortion, never observed an abortion, never observed or performed or learned how to do a D&C, which is what? A procedure that you do after a woman has had a miscarriage, which is a perfectly legitimate reason, but you can object for your own personal religious reasons. So I always urge people to ask your OBGYN what their experience is and what their position is on abortion or on D&Cs. I mean, you can have an OBGYN who knows absolutely nothing about that and would prefer not to learn about that. So if you feel strongly that they know those types of things, my suggestion is to ask. I think access to abortion, for a lot of people, it affects young people the most. It affects women of color. It affects low-income women. Those are the women who have the most difficulty getting abortion for a variety of reasons. The provider shortage that I just talked about, people are not graduating from med school saying, I'm going to be an abortion provider. And there's a wide variety of reasons for that. There's violence against abortion providers. There's a stigma in society against abortion providers. They're not learning about abortion. There's a whole, bunch of reasons. There's a perception that you don't make any money, and you don't. You don't make as much money as graduating from from med school and becoming going into surgery or going into some other profession. And restrictive legislation, like the ones that I talked about, cost, like I talked about. And I think that, you know, pro-life people or anti-choice people have become very, very good at closing down clinics. In Mississippi, for instance, there's one clinic. 5 years ago, there were nine. There's one clinic in Mississippi, in the entire state of Mississippi, and they have a 24-hour waiting period where you have to come back in person. So, and Mississippi has been targeted by pro-life organizations as we're going to shut down those clinics. They do it in a variety of ways. They buy buildings that abortion clinics reside in, and then they evict them when their lease runs out, which happened in Kansas. Which actually, I read a Fox News article when I was doing a little bit of research for this, specifically talking about as a new tactic about buying real estate and evicting abortion clinics. They make it too expensive to run the clinic, which happens in a lot, especially southern states. They pass laws in the legislature called trap laws. And what those are is, well, I'll read you one of the laws. Any clinic that performs more than 10 abortions per week, the abortion procedure and recovery room shall have a minimum of 6 air changes per hour. All air supply to procedure rooms shall be delivered at or near the ceiling and must pass through a minimum of 1 filter bed with a minimum filter efficiency of 80%. Only applied to abortion clinics, not applied to other healthcare clinics. It says it right in the legislation. So what they do is they make it so difficult to renovate the clinic, expensive to, I mean, sometimes nonsensical things that you have to do to a clinic. And this is, I mean, this is an intentional, targeted thing, which is that you will have to spend so much money renovating this clinic to be able to comply with these trap laws that you won't be, you'll be forced to leave business. And this happens all over the place. And they've been very, very successful at this. That happened in North Carolina. That law is actually on the books in North Carolina. That's where I got that. Another law in that kind of area is that doctors must have admitting privileges to a hospital within a 15-minute drive. So for some clinics, that's simply not possible. You wouldn't be able to get to the hospital in 15 minutes. And so then when that law passes, then there's no way to move, you know, you can't physically lift up your clinic and move it somewhere else, so clinics close for that reason. And they create a hostile environment. They target doctors' families, neighbors, businesses, until ultimately people don't want to be, you know, don't want to go out of business or they don't want to be abortion doctors anymore. And then violence, of course, is another way. just this year in New Mexico, in December, there are 3 abortion clinics were firebombed. I think it's something that we think of as not happening anymore, but it does happen, and it makes people afraid to go there, to work there, to be patients there. And so all of that happened in Albuquerque. I'll read you just a little bit in conclusion from this book that Joseph Scheidler wrote. He's an anti-abortion activist. He wrote Closed, 99 Ways to Stop Abortion. So the introduction says, since the activities and methods proposed in this book are intended to interfere with and stop the business of abortion, when you use them, clinic personnel may file complaints against you or call the police and have you arrested. Cases resulting from these actions will often be dismissed, but they must also result in some form of penalty, fines, or supervision. So this book basically has chapters in it which give people the tools to be able to close abortion clinics. Harassment of patients and doctors is chapter 2. It may be necessary for the sidewalk counselor to get the woman's name and phone number and help her during her pregnancy. It is not enough to talk her out of the abortion. You will need to call parents, husband, neighbors, boyfriends, whatever the problem, just keep talking to them. Advocating, really, just keep harassing people until they don't have the abortion. We actually had a patient at Midwest, where I work, who didn't speak English, who was very young. And we have sidewalk people out in front of our clinic. And the protesters actually told her she was in the wrong spot and had her get in the van that was there. And they drove her to a crisis pregnancy center where they sat her in a chair and showed her films about what would happen to her and what would, you know, why not to have an abortion. She was 15. So she really, her counselor called our clinic and said, why did you do that? Why did you guys show? She thought that that was us, that we had done that. She said, why did you show her all these videos? It took us probably a week to get to the bottom of the issue, which is essentially she was kidnapped from our clinic. She was on the street outside of our clinic and driven to Robbinsdale, where they have a crisis pregnancy center, and they proceeded to, you know, scare the crap out of her. Had somebody, you know, said they were a doctor, come out and talk to her about a lot of the myths that I just told you about. Regardless of how you feel about abortion, whether you feel like you shouldn't, you know, I would never have an abortion, or I don't really, you know, feel like it's morally right, those sort of tactics are probably, you know, I find them reprehensible. I have lots of people I know who don't want to have abortions, and I have in-laws who are totally against abortion, but I think that there's a certain amount of respect we have to give people who are patients and who are exercising their right to have abortion. So the last tactic is adopting a provider that Joseph Scheidler advocates. And he tells a story about one of our pro-lifers decided he would adopt one of the female abortion advocates in Chicago. He accompanied her on lobbying missions. He followed her from one legislator's office to the other, all the time praying for her. He attended her seminars, encouraged her friends to fill up front rows. He challenged her to public debates, organized people to question her at talks, went to her house, went to her business, sent her pro-life literature all the time, told her neighbors what she did, took every opportunity to get her. This went on for years, and finally she quit. So it's effective. I mean, if people came to your house and told all your neighbors what you did and sent you things and did things like that, you would probably quit too. So these are very effective tactics on closing clinics. So that sort of is an overview. And nobody asked any questions. So does anybody have any questions now before you have to go to class? Sure. It hasn't been very successful up until this point. Well, I mean, I used to write restraining orders, and generally restraining orders, you could potentially argue harassment, but there is such a stigma around this, and there's really a lot of First Amendment rights that go along with this, and that's really how it's viewed, as people's First Amendment rights. So they haven't been very successful. I mean, some of the more extreme cases, I suppose, have been, but in my experience, I haven't really anybody. Right. Probably. Yeah. Yes. Almost every clinic has their own volunteer program of escorts. And the day that that happened, we didn't have any escorts. Generally, most days we have one or two escorts who stand outside in bright yellow vests who help women sort of walk past sidewalk counselors and get into the clinic. And so most clinics do have that. So that's very helpful. I got more threats when I was a battered women's advocate, actually. Yeah. I mean, certainly when I got lots of mail at the clinic that was just, or, you know, we get lots of mail, and we got lots of mail when I was at Pro-Choice Resources about, you know, lots of various things. But there, I've never had an overt threat. I mean, I think that, I sort of said this before, but I honestly think, I mean, not that that doesn't happen. I think in Minnesota it happens a little bit less than some other states. I think most efforts seem, and most people who oppose abortion don't really go that far. I mean, honestly, in all fairness, most people who, oppose abortion, violence is not their first tactic, and threats are not their first tactic. All these other things are their first tactic. And so I don't want to represent that all pro-life people are violent or, you know, that kind of thing, because I don't think that that's true at all. so I think most, you know, it was much more effective to do these other things, you know, in the long run. I think in people's viewpoints, it's much more effective to try and close clinics or try and pass legislation, that type of stuff. So, but most of our doctors here have. Most of our doctors have their cars registered to the clinic address, because Planned Parenthood, for instance, And at Robbinsdale Clinic, almost all the staff people have their cars registered to those addresses because protesters do take down license plates of people who work there and do go to the DMV and do searches and find out their address so that they're able to do these types of things and write them letters and send things to their neighbors and that type of thing. So, yeah, that definitely does happen. Yeah. In Robbinsdale, where one of the abortion clinics is, right across the street, there's the Robbinsdale Women's Clinic, which is an abortion clinic, and the Robbinsdale Women's Center, which is an anti-abortion place. So, I mean, you know, half the time, people go into the wrong clinic and think they're at the abortion clinic, but they're not. I mean, it is a full-time job. There are more crisis pregnancy centers in the United States than there are abortion clinics. And they're, you know, that is definitely one of the things that they do. Our legislator just gave $5 million to crisis pregnancy centers in order to keep perpetrating these things, you know, 2 years ago. So, and they will again this year give them $5 million more probably. So, I mean, it's a business. It's a full-time business, definitely. And yes, they tell people absolutely false things. And a lot of times it's the places where you can go for a free pregnancy test. And so here in St. Cloud, what is it, Birthline and the Pregnancy Resource Center, which both sound like great options when you have no money and you need a pregnancy test. So, I mean, I've done it. When I was up here, I called some place that said they gave out free pregnancy tests and ended up getting way more than I wanted, you know, when I went in there. But that's, I mean, they're offering free pregnancy tests, and they're offering it on the side of buses and on KMOJ or, you know, on different radio stations. And that's how they're getting people, you know. And then you go in there for your free pregnancy test or whatever, and then they talk to you about abortion and show you videos or, you know. No, because they never say they do abortions. They just say pregnancy options counseling, pregnancy options. They advertise in the yellow pages under abortion, but they never say they do abortion. I think people think, gosh, it can't be as bad as you really say. These people aren't that organized. They are way more organized than us. They are way, way more organized with a lot more money. I mean, if they put a fraction of their money into prenatal care and caring for the children who were already here as opposed to putting the billboards on your way down to Minneapolis, it would be awesome. We would have much better health care, much better options, you know. But, and those billboards, by the way, if you notice when you're driving back from Minneapolis, there are none. They're only on the way to the abortion clinics so that you will change your mind when you see them. So, yeah. Well, I think that I know what Planned Parenthood's money goes for. It's the same thing that my clinic's money goes for. It gives out free birth control to poor people. It goes to services to people as opposed to advocating. And, I mean, that's why, in all honesty, the pro-choice movement is losing the marketing battle, because our money isn't being spent on marketing. Our money is being spent on helping poor people prevent pregnancies. I mean, we lose $500,000 a year at the clinic that I work on under and uninsured people, because we give them services. Birth control, annual exams, $500,000 a year that we fundraise from other sources. I could take that $500,000 and do a billboard campaign. You know, I think that we're using our money for different things, in my opinion. So, Anything else? Okay, we're out of time. Go to class. Thank you.